It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
The other stumbling block is that it's important to have usually a court reporter present who can swear the plaintiff and the witness in and then transcribe it. That was expensive. So not only is it difficult to do for what we call pro se litigants, people who are not represented by attorneys, but it was also often cost prohibitive because it would add hundreds of dollars to what would otherwise be a case that would require maybe a $65 filing fee.
Christy Mara, family law attorney at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, explains how the doors of the courthouse have opened a little wider for parties seeking an uncontested no-fault divorce on the grounds of living separate and apart for the required time. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn about the Deferred Action Program that may allow immigrants brought to the country illegally by their parents to remain and avoid deportation. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 176, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Immigrants brought to the country illegally by their parents will likely not face prosecution or other repercussions, and neither will their families, if they apply for a new federal program that allows them to avoid deportation. Beginning August 15, certain illegal immigrants can apply for the Deferred Action Program. This will release them from deportation proceedings and allow them to apply for work permits. The renewable status will last 2 years. But officials also warned that applicants for deferred action who knowingly lie, attempt fraud, or do not meet the criteria but apply anyway could be considered immigration enforcement priorities and turned over to prosecutors for removal proceedings. To apply for deferred action, immigrants must have been brought to the country before they were 16 and must be younger than 31 as of June 15, 2012. They must have graduated or currently be enrolled in school, must have lived in the country consistently since June 15, 2007, and may not have been convicted of a serious misdemeanor, three misdemeanors, or a felony. Officials with the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, the agency that oversees legal immigration, said a strong confidentiality agreement was essential to ensure that as many immigrants take advantage of the process as possible. USCIS also issued a stern warning that if the agency deems that information should be turned over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement for prosecution, it will not hesitate. Applicants must submit an application for consideration for deferred action and a separate form requesting work authorization, which will serve as a secure identification document. The cost of the application will be $465, and the money will be used to hire staff for the program. Fee waivers are not available, although exemptions may be granted on a limited basis. Applicants should expect to wait months before learning a decision on their applications. Application status can be tracked through an online system the USCIS will unveil this month. Some lawmakers and the Immigration Policy Center estimate that between 800,000 and 1.4 million people could benefit from the policy. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's legal term of the week is motion to amend or review order. A motion to amend or review order is a court paper filed to change a court order. Usually a child custody, child visitation, child support, or spousal support order. You may file this at any time after the prior court order. However, you must have a material or important change in circumstances or events since the prior court order was entered. On a motion to amend or review order, no one can bring up things that happened at or before the last court hearing. The parties can only bring up things that happened since the last court hearing. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and motion to amend or review order is this week's legal term of the week.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Virginia Poverty Law Center. We're speaking with family law attorney Christy Mara, and we will be speaking about a recent legislative change that took effect on July 1, 2012, that can make it a bit easier to get an uncontested no-fault divorce. Welcome back to the show, Christy.
Thank you, Mario. Always nice to be here.
Always nice to have you as a guest. Now, in order to understand what the change is to get an uncontested no-fault divorce in Virginia, I think it's first important to understand what the current procedures are. And even before that, it's important to understand what are and what are not the grounds for a divorce in Virginia. Would you tell our listeners what are the grounds for a divorce in Virginia?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, the one most important to our conversation today is something called living separate and apart. And it is exactly what it sounds like. If two people who are married live in separate homes, and when they separate, at least one of them intends the separation to be permanent, then once they've been separated for 12 months, they are entitled to get what we colloquially call an uncontested divorce. In fact, if they don't have any minor children and they enter into a written property settlement agreement, they're entitled to seek that uncontested divorce after being separated for 6 months.
And when you say uncontested, I gather that once the separation has gone on for the required period, 12 months in most cases, or 6 months if there are no minor children and the parties have a separation agreement, it really can't be stopped by the opposing party, even if they want to stop it.
That's correct. There's no defense, if you will, to one of these divorces based on being separated for the requisite amount of time. If you can show that you've been separated however many months you need to be, given your circumstances, then you are entitled to a divorce. Now, it isn't enough for you to show it. There does have to be a corroborating witness who also can testify as to the key facts, which we'll go over a little bit later. But basically, in addition to just showing the court that you're in the right court, the key fact is that the two parties have been separated for either 6 or 12 months, and that at least one of the parties wanted that separation to be permanent. There are other types of civil cases where you can get something called a default judgment as a plaintiff if the defendant doesn't show up. And in that case, as the plaintiff, you get to go to court, tell the judge what happened and what you want, and you get your judgment. Virginia law does not allow a divorce to be granted based on a default judgment. There has to be that additional witness saying, yes, all of this is true.
And that's true even in the uncontested no-fault divorce. Now, before we go on to the procedures, just tell us briefly, what are the other grounds for a divorce in Virginia other than the uncontested no-fault divorce?
The grounds are adultery, cruelty and what the law calls reasonable apprehension of bodily harm, the other party being convicted of a felony and incarcerated for more than 12 months, and abandonment.
Okay, so let's go now to the procedures to actually get a divorce, whether it's an uncontested no-fault divorce or whether it's a fault-based divorce based upon one of the four grounds that you just went through. If someone wants a divorce...
So the first thing that somebody seeking a divorce needs to do is to draft and file something called a complaint. And in the complaint, that person called the plaintiff will set out all of the facts that he or she has to prove to get whatever type of divorce he or she is seeking. So if somebody were seeking, for example, a divorce based on cruelty and reasonable apprehension of bodily harm, their complaint would have to include a description of the events that made them fearful, a description of the cruelty. With your uncontested divorce, the complaint is pretty straightforward. You know, it includes statements just showing the court that the plaintiff is in the right court, covering things we call venue and jurisdiction, and then states the date that the parties were separated, states the fact that the plaintiff intended that separation to be permanent, and also will state whether or not the parties have any minor children in common and whether they entered into a property settlement agreement.
Okay, so this complaint with all these facts is filed with the circuit court.
That's right.
What happens next?
So once that's filed, it will then be served on the defendant through the sheriff's office. And that can be either by giving it to the sheriff, giving it to the defendant in person, or posting it on the door, or leaving it with someone in the house who's over the age of 18. It is also possible, though, and often done in more amicable uncontested divorces, for the plaintiff to give the defendant something called a waiver to sign. And by signing that waiver, the defendant says, I'm fine with getting divorced. We've talked about it. You don't need to serve any paperwork on me at all. Once the complaint or the complaint and the waiver have been filed and the complaint has been served, if there is no waiver, the defendant has 21 days to file an answer. The defendant can, if he or she wants to, sort of shake things up when they file the answer, because it's possible, even in an uncontested divorce, for the defendant to file an answer alleging one of those fault grounds that I mentioned, the list I went through earlier. But assuming that that doesn't happen, then the next step, once and the defendant doesn't even have to file an answer. After those 21 days, under what has been happening until July 1, the plaintiff would have to send either appear in court at a hearing with her witness to testify under oath that everything she said in the complaint was true, and for her witness to do the same. Or, and this was far more common, is far more common, actually do that testimony in front of a notary, in front of a court reporter, and actually produce written depositions of herself and her witness to be filed with the court. And in either case, that plaintiff has to give notice to the defendant.
And I gather that was a major problem, that people could file their divorce complaint and probably get everything right in the written complaint, and they could get it served through one of those methods, either personal service or service on a household member, or having it posted and mailed, or possibly accepted with a waiver. Those two steps were not too difficult, but then it was this divorce deposition step that was the real hang-up. What was the problem people had in actually getting the divorce deposition properly done?
Well, I think certainly for people who are not represented by attorneys, there are certain forms that the questions have to be in. There are certain questions that need to be asked. And most folks don't know how to do that if they haven't gone to law school. The other stumbling block is that it's important to have usually a court reporter present who can swear the plaintiff and the witness in and then transcribe it. That was expensive. So not only is it difficult to do for what we call pro se litigants, people who are not represented by attorneys, but it was also often cost prohibitive because it would add hundreds of dollars to what would otherwise be a case that would require maybe a $65 filing fee. So it really astronomically increased the cost. And for people who had attorneys, what it did for attorneys was it really sort of slowed down the process because by being required to take the depositions or go to court, they had to set aside a chunk of time to do that. And that would delay everything for all of the divorce cases they had.
And just to finish up the procedures prior to July 1, once that deposition was taken and was transcribed at a cost of hundreds of dollars, what happened next? How did the final divorce decree get entered?
What generally happened is that those depositions would be filed with the court, and then different courts have different practices in terms of how they want to see that final decree. But someone has to draft the final decree and send it into court. Some courts will just look at that in the depositions and sign the final decree. Others will require formal notice to the defendant. Others will require first something called a precipe that simply says, please give me a date to submit the final decree, and that precipe has to be filed, and then another notice has to be filed with the court. So it really varies across jurisdictions.
So it sounds like this type of hassle and technicality is something that the General Assembly was trying to do away with.
Bit by bit. This was sort of, I think there are still going to be some difficulties in the way different courts do different things, and that's simply unavoidable because there is a lot of discretion there. But the concern was twofold, I think, and I think I've sort of given you a sense of what they were. First, that pro se litigants simply got stuck. They got stuck. They would file the complaint, and then when it came time to put on their evidence through a deposition, they would get stuck. And these cases would sit and sit and sit and clog up dockets, and nothing would happen. And that's not good for the courts or for the pro se litigants. And then the other thing was the family law attorneys actually had been very, very critical in persuading the General Assembly that they wanted this. The Virginia Bar Association Family Law Legislative Coalition took a very active role in persuading the General Assembly that this was a better way to handle evidence in these uncontested divorces. So a lot of folks came together.
So what is the new way that it can be done? First of all, I guess tell us when can the new way be used, and then what is the new way?
Well, the big picture is that the new way allows for the use of a written affidavit instead of these depositions that have to be taken in front of a notary or going to court. An affidavit is simply a written statement that sets out everything that the plaintiff would otherwise have to testify to. So it's essentially written testimony that the plaintiff prepares and then signs in front of a notary public. Now, not everybody can use this affidavit process. It is only available, as we've already discussed, for people who are seeking one of those uncontested divorces. And then it's only available if one of three circumstances exist in the case.
And what are those?
First, that the parties have signed a property settlement agreement that resolves all their issues. So if they have children, the property settlement agreement deals with custody, visitation, and support. If they have property, the property settlement agreement deals with that. If somebody wants spousal support, the property settlement agreement deals with that. So that's one way. The second way is if there are two people who simply want to get divorced. They have no children, or at least they have no children under the age of 18. They have no property that needs to be divided up, and nobody is asking for support. They simply need to get the divorce. And in that case, they can use the affidavit process. And then the final circumstance under which you can use the affidavit is if the sheriff hands it to the defendant, which is called personal service, and the defendant does nothing, and we can assume that defendant shrugs and says, yeah, sure, this sounds fine, then the plaintiff can use the affidavits.
And now, under this new procedure, what if the defendant signs a waiver? Is that going to also be considered personal service to allow this procedure to be used, or is that still an open, unknown question?
I think that's an open question, Marty. I think, you know, that never was brought up during the very, you know, brief hearings on this bill during the General Assembly session. I would expect, my opinion is, if the defendant signs a waiver of personal service, you should be able to use the affidavit. However, because the statute expressly says that the defendant has to be personally served, there are some judges who are going to say, no, the waiver is not sufficient. So I think we'll have to, that's an excellent question, one I hadn't thought of, and I think we're going to have to see how that plays out over the next year. And it may be that if that causes some problems, we may see ourselves back in the General Assembly in 2014 asking for that little problem to be fixed.
Now, assuming someone wants to use this procedure, and assuming it is available because one of those three grounds applies, how does someone know specifically what's supposed to be in the affidavit of the party and what is supposed to be in the affidavit of the party's witness?
You know, I think the General Assembly did a really, really nice job with this, because if you go to the code section itself, it sets out everything that needs to be in the plaintiff's affidavit and everything that needs to be in the affidavit of the witness. So all someone would have to do would be to find that code section and look at those two listings. We'll really spell it out.
And then when and how does this affidavit get filed? Does it get filed with the complaint? Does it get filed after the complaint has been filed and the defendant served? Is that an open question?
I don't think so. I think that's a little bit more clear, because I would say that the plaintiff should wait 21 days after service to see if the defendant is going to file an answer. Because if the defendant files an answer that says, wait a minute, I don't agree with this date that you have in the complaint, for example, or wait a minute, there actually is a property issue. You know, the plaintiff may say there are no property issues to be decided, et cetera, and the defendant may raise that, in which case you can't use these affidavits. So I would wait 21 days, wait and see if the defendant files an answer, and then at that point you can file the affidavits with the court.
And then how does the divorce finally get granted? Is that going to be similar to the current procedure that once a deposition is filed, that a proposed final decree would get filed along with the affidavit?
That would be the best way to go, would be to file both the affidavits, that of the witness and the plaintiff, along with a proposed final decree. Anybody doing this on their own without an attorney should call the clerk's office and ask the clerk what needs to happen. Do I need to set a court date to present all of this? Can I just mail it in? What do I need to do? Because each court, as I said, will have a slightly different procedure. Now, we, the legal aid community, is actually working on some documents that will be available online that will conform to this new procedure. We're not quite there yet, so they're not up and running yet, but we hope to have everything up and running by October.
And it sounds like we'll probably be back on the radio sometime later this year talking about that.
That would be wonderful, Marty.
All right, well, thank you so much, Christy. We have been talking with Christy Mara. She is a family law attorney at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, and we were talking about the new uncontested no-fault divorce procedure that took effect July 1, allowing evidence to be submitted by affidavit. Thank you so much, Christy.
Thank you, Marty.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's top three tips are about changing a child custody or visitation order. The first tip is that once child custody or visitation has been set, it can't be changed unless there has been a material or important change in circumstances or events since the prior court order. Without this, the court is not very likely to amend or change the last order. The second tip is that you can't bring up anything that took place at or before the last court hearing. You can only bring up things that took place since the last court hearing. The third tip is that if there has been an important change since the prior court order, you would file a motion to amend or review order. You file this with the court that issued the last order. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and for this week, that's our top three tips.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral four, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wagbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. When the debt collector calls, are you better off speaking with them or not? Join us next week when private attorney Dan Rosenthal talks about how to handle debt collectors and debt collectors' rights and duties under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegebrand.